Thanks for tuning in to Bitches on Comics. This week, we have a trigger warning because we're talking about Warren Ellis comics and United States history. A lot of trigger warnings in that. You can read further notes on the episode guide at our website, www.bitchesoncomics.com.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back for another episode of Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, Essie Fleenor.
And I'm Sarah Sentry. And today we have a very special guest, Veronique Imahubois.
Hello. It's awesome to be here. This is now finally the third time that I've done a podcast with Sarah. I think it's three now.
Nope, we're at three right now, this is the second one in the last couple months. So
yes, it's very exciting. Went for literal years without doing it, and here we are. It's always kind of weird to try to describe myself because I am in one of those kind of multi-hyphenates because I bounce around in different things. But most relevant to this podcast is that I have worked in and around the comic book industry as a creator, a consultant, and a critic. I'm best known for critical writing, some of which has been published in some really neat places like Critical Chips for Short Box. And, I did a script for DC and IDW's Love is Love anthology that was responding to the Pulse shooting a while ago. But I typically write a column called Transmascara for Comicosity, which is just my sort of like freeform whatever I want to write about comics with. And I'm also a drag queen, and my drag name is Due to Slays, and I very occasionally do Red from the Rafters, where I just kind of do stream of consciousness and cultural critique and that kind of stuff. But typically you can just find me on Twitter at Imahubois, Imahouxbois.
Excellent. So I was going to say too that the Suspiria review that you did as Judith, I still think about because I watched it right after the movie. So it turned into, I believe that that's a fairly long episode. And so it went from this extremely long movie to watching this very long review about it. And so it just made an entire experience out of it. So I appreciate you doing that.
Thank you. It was like, it ran over 2 hours. It was very early into my recording videos phase, and I thought that I could actually handle my shit if I was drinking while I was doing it, and that was clearly a huge mistake, because there's all of these wild tangents into the principles of Freudian psychoanalysis, and they're legit, but it could have been boiled down into 5 minutes instead of 15 minutes with a lot of hand waving. But I really appreciate that you actually stuck through that entire thing, because I do really adore that movie in its own way. I don't like to compare it to the older one because they're both great movies doing two very, very different things. But yeah. So in prose, if I'm going to sit down and do something like write about Iron Man Extremis, I can run for 7,000, 8,000, sometimes up to 12,000 words and kind of edit down and go. So it's a much more forgiving medium, I think, when I am in print, and kind of why I sort of have two wildly different personalities out there, where if you read my stuff in prose, it's very focused, it's very to the point. But if you catch me talking or on video, things go a little haywire.
I don't know. It's so cool that you have these two different ways of talking about a lot of the stuff that I care about. So it's awesome. But you just had this article that went up on Comicosity, I believe, which was about Iron Man Extremis. And yeah, I was kind of amazed by this. I mean, I'm amazed by a lot of your work, so this might be a repetitive statement, but I was very interested. I have no idea why you started, I guess, the Warren Ellis retrospective kind of, because you wrote a little bit about other series by Ellis.
Well, it all started with Next Wave Agents of Hate. And then the whole thing, I've actually 3 or 4 different times forgotten why I did it. But it's actually in at the very end of that piece, very helpfully, was that Steve Morris at Shelf Dust did this really, really cool thing where he contacted 100 critics and asked them for their top 10 single issues of all time. And then he aggregated them and found out from 100 to 1 what the most popular ones along the way were, and what and kind of created the closest thing that we've had to a critical consensus in comics since the Comics Create Internet was like 6 blogs on, like, you know, Blogger and WordPress, like, over 10 years ago. So because of how kind of fractured and disjointed and just how many different, I used to call them, like, audiences that comic book sites try to reach, you know, a lot of us just don't travel in the same circles. So it was really neat that Steve just went all the way out there and found all these people, and we learned just so much in that moment about what people read, what they like, and why they care about it in a way that I don't think I had ever seen since I started writing about comics. Well, I guess kind of came back in a big way and made a name for myself in 2014 when I started at the Rainbow Hub and got a piece in a bitch. But the thing that struck me about it is that there was, like, I think there was only like 2 Warren Ellis comics in the entire thing. And one of them was an issue of Moon Knight, which is certainly cool, but it was just such a hyper contemporary example of Ellis's work that is kind of a weird thing to be like the one thing pretty much that made it in there, because, like, I've been reading Warren Ellis since the early 2000s. Like, I don't know if I started with Transmetropolitan, or maybe I read a little bit of The Authority first, but so I've been reading his comics for almost 20 years and jumping around in terms of the publishing order. So it was just kind of really shocking to me that he had fallen so far out of the critical zeitgeist. But when I did the math, you see, like, there's a tons of Matt Fraction. I think there's a little bit of Kelly Sue DeConnick in there. There's Brian K. Vaughan. There was, like, Kieran Gillen as far as writers go. So a lot of the writers that were in there were people that I remember, you know, worked their way into the comic book industry and got famous through Whitechapel and Warren Ellis's other websites, where he had, like, created these little pre-Twitter communities for people to chat at. You know, I still have a dead laptop somewhere that has a sticker from The Engine on it, you know? So I was kind of like, well, let's school these kids a little bit. Like, let's teach them about Uncle Warren, that, you know, he existed before Castlevania. And, you know, I kind of understand it, because if you've been reading comics for only 5 years or maybe 10 years and you jumped in, wow, like, Saga blew your mind because you never read a Brian K. Vaughan comic before or whatever, and that's cool. But, or, you know, Wictive was your big entry point into the industry. And I'm like, I'm seeing how young and how new this critical establishment is, you know. And so I was kind of like, well, geez, I want to show them why this was so neat and why to jump into it. And I don't know why, for the love of God, I decided that Next Wave was the Warren Ellis comic I had to start with. But that's that's what happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a person who has been writing comics for pretty much a billion years. I remember probably the first thing I read from him was maybe Excalibur. I think it might have been the Moira McTaggart gets drunk at the bar and cries and Rain has to help carry her home era. But yeah, I've been reading his comics, I believe, pretty much as long as I've been reading comics. It might have been a couple of years difference or something, but it's very interesting how long he's been around and kind of how ubiquitous he was for a while, because he did that Hellstrom series, just, you know, kind of comes in halfway through and makes this really interesting series out of something that was absolutely flailing. And I think that was kind of his mark for a little while. It's sort of the same as like a Grant Morrison or something, where people are like, will you take this? You know, nobody else is doing this. And he kind of jumps in. So after seeing kind of a lot of his creator-owned stuff, like Transmetropolitan, that would qualify as a creator-owned book, yeah. I mean, I guess it's like through Vertigo, but...
Yeah, it is. I mean, technically it started under Helix, which was going to be...
That's right.
DC's attempt at more of a 2000 AD or like heavy metal type of a sci-fi focused thing, because you'll still see every once in a while pictures of the first issue with that on it. But it got moved to Transmetropolitan. So it's considered as like a second generation creator-owned Vertigo title, because the Holy Trinity of the first 3 major creator-owned titles of Vertigo were like The Invisibles, Preacher, and... It was Invisibles and Preacher. It was 2. And then everything else kind of fanned out from there. But yeah.
Right. So this is somebody who's just been around forever. And now he kind of has, I guess, his own corners that he kind of gets to play with. And it's stuff that he started a really long time ago. And I just don't know if he foresaw where it was going to end up going, you know, if he would still be working on these characters such a long time later. But it's interesting to see him doing books like Supreme Blue Rose or, you know, The Wildstorm, all of that stuff after years and years and years. You know, he does so many interesting books, I think, that he has to be one of the better comic writers because I find, you know, so much of it very compelling in a way that holds up. I was really surprised by Iron Man Extremis because I really wrote that book off whenever it first came out. I'm not an Iron Man fan, but it's actually a really good book. And I was kind of shocked by that, I guess, because it's really hard to make me like Tony Stark.
I also struggle with Tony Stark. I find, I mean, RDJ is one thing. I'm sorry, he's just so pretty. But Tony Stark, I've just always been like, I don't know, man. But especially having read your article, I was like, okay, I can see all these layers and resonance here that I hadn't read Extremis before I'd read your article. I found it like fascinating, actually. And I always enjoy Ellis's dialogue personally. I think it's one of the things he is best at. And I just really was able to get into the story and appreciate what was happening with the different characters and their backgrounds and what Ellis was gesturing to off the page in sort of Americana history. You know, I didn't know a lot about the Ruby Ridge incident or any of that. I remember seeing it as a kid, but it was different to sort of read about it in your work. And then I went and read some things off the page as well, reinforcing everything that's happening at play in Extremis and how different Extremis is the comic versus the trilogy for how it situates the person's power who takes on Extremis. I thought that was pretty freaking incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I made a joke when we released the article that my original title for it was Only True 90s Kids Remember the Oklahoma City Bombing.
Right.
and this is that's kind of the whole thing about Extremis, but you know, to dial back a little bit, like, you know, you both said you have trouble liking Tony Stark, but the whole thing is that you are never, ever supposed to like Tony Stark. Like, you go back to what Stan Lee says that he originally thought, you know, and God rest Stan Lee, because he loves to go back and reinvent what he originally said. But if you take it on faith, he was trying to create an anti-hero, somebody who would be difficult to root for. And so he was like, what about a war profiteer, right? And of course, he doesn't actually have the scripting credit for the first issue. So it's kind of tough to know exactly, you know, without talking to the other creators who actually ended up executing the original idea, whether they carried forward with trying to make him unlikable or not, because I don't think they do. He comes across as the dashing cold warrior that he has been for most of his history. So Warren Ellis, you know, at various times has lamented the fact that Jack Kirby and Stan Lee really brought superheroes back from the brink of destruction. And he kind of hated that fact for a long time, and he's tried to kill superheroes, and he's raged against them for a long time. He stopped doing that. He hasn't been doing that for over 10 years now. He's just kind of like, well, it is what it is, and here we are. But it's so ironic because he kind of goes back to the purity of the original concept of that original statement by Stan Lee and says, what if I made this guy who was tough to cheer for because of the industry that he works in, right? And it's some of the dialogue in Extremis is so hard to believe that it got through now after that whole shit show when there was that defense contractor, was it Northrop Grumman or whatever they're called?
Yeah.
Did that propaganda comic advertisement for Marvel Comics where it was like, you can be the real Tony Stark, you know, and build the drones that kill people at weddings in Afghanistan. You know, and people rightly said, fuck you, right, to that. And
yes.
And you go back now, and I think Extremis, not just Extremis, obviously, but Extremis was one of the reasons why people had such a visceral reaction to saying, no, absolutely not. Do we want this in Marvel Comics? You know, because Ellis stepped up and he reminded us, because there's that great exchange with the documentary filmmaker where he's saying, like, you build landmines. That has to be, as far as technology goes and defense contracting, war-related stuff, building and selling and deploying landmines has to be one of the most despicable things that you can do, right? And,
yes.
you know, and we have kind of Lady Diana and the Ottawa Treaty to thank for that, because they mm-hmm. said, like, look, like, these children all over the world getting their legs blown off and dying and all this stuff, just completely innocent civilians dying under these things. And Warren Ellis convinced Joe Quesada, I believe that's who the EIC would have been at the time, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to say that this is what Tony Stark did. This is who Tony Stark was. And to really hammer that home so early yeah. in the comic.
And that it was a legacy thing, right? That his dad had been that involved in, like, things that were not that, but that were also equally terrible, right?
The Manhattan Project.
Right.
Which, you know, by implication means that what happened in Winter Soldier with Hydra, you know, and S.H.I.E.L.D. bringing in Hydra people to work for them from the beginning is just a metaphor for Operation Paperclip, right? For right. The Nazi physicists and scientists being brought on to work on nuclear weapons and whatnot in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so the heavy implication there is that, yeah, like Howard Stark was definitely working with Nazis on the Manhattan Project. And in the movies, of course, the Manhattan Project is the huge metaphor for, like, the one great thing that Howard Stark did that creates the legacy for Tony to answer to. And they never critique the Manhattan Project because it's right. like a Disney. Well, I mean, I know they started out under Paramount, but especially after but Disney, Mr. Pro-Nuclear Walt Disney, that, yeah, right?
Right. Yeah, good God. A lot of the stuff that you brought up in this article that to me is so interesting, like something I love about a lot of your work is that it helps set a time and a tone, and you have the space to do that. And that's always something that's really great. And, you know, something that I think adds a lot to your pieces, because it helps me to be like, right, these other 17 things were happening at that time, right? I mean, obviously Extremis stands on its own because it's something that's kind of, rather than vindicating Tony, I think it definitely implicates him in a lot of really terrible things. And then he has to struggle with that. And then it's not even totally about his struggle. It's about a lot of other things that are going on. And so I think that he does it right in a lot of ways. And some other writers do as well. But you were bringing up a lot of, and of course, this links to your, you know, Lois Lane article a little bit, talking about this time period, how a lot of writers, even if they were liberal or if they were conservative, were kind of spouting that same party line that war is absolutely necessary. No matter what direction you go in, you're going to have a war, you know? And so I think that that was part of what was so compelling about this piece in specific, was just kind of being like, I think about the history of propaganda in comics, because there's always been propaganda in comics, but the placement of this exact time period where everything was rearing up, I guess, you talking about the way that Ellis intersects with those other stories, I think was really interesting.
Yeah, and it gets down to interventionism, right? And you had mentioned that I did that deep dive into Greg Rucka's history, and in how he does this institutional lens on comics, how he views comics through the intelligence agencies, right, or through the military, and these other kind of ways where he just has this hyper-institutional lens, and how he guided the way that espionage and the military were viewed in Marvel and DC Comics with such a firm and unmistakable hand. And it's a fascinating part of Rucka's history. But interventionism specifically is such a fascinating topic in superhero comics because they're entirely a product of the 20th century. And you go back to World War II, and this is like one of the things to me about Warren Ellis. Like I've used this phrase in like three different pieces. I call him a restless oil painter, because if you read a lot of his work close together, you start to see the rhymes. You start to see him taking an essay that he wrote for GQ, you know, that, like, I don't know, five people might remember. And then he puts exact lines of dialogue from that into the Wildstorm, this whole paranoid rant about Elon Musk. And you're like, holy shit, he actually keeps track of all of the stuff that he writes. Like, he somehow has it organized so that he can come back to it later. And I was like, this dude is so organized. This is wild. Especially for someone whose body of work is so obscenely diffuse. He's even just in comics, but beyond that, he has done little things everywhere. He is spread out everywhere. He is those little cluster munitions that they talk about in the comic. You find little bits and pieces of his stuff everywhere. So I try to open myself up the same way and present these ideas as I find them, knowing that Ellis might change his perspective on them or I might change my perspective on them. So I want to open myself to build for future pieces, because when I did Lois Lane, I wrote the Lois Lane piece halfway through the Iron Man piece. So I already knew what I was doing, because the Extremis piece was long coming. You see references to it in my piece on the Wildstorm, because I started to understand these rhyming things between Maya Hansen and the new version of the Engineer and so on. So I got to thinking about interventionism. And actually, a great dovetail to this is anybody who's watching the HBO series, The Plot Against America. You'll understand exactly what I'm talking about here, because interventionism, military interventionism in the 1930s, in the run-up to World War II and when World War II happened, a large part of it was driven by Jewish Americans who saw what was happening. They're like, we need to stop. We didn't really have the term the Holocaust, but they knew what it was. And we have to intervene and stop this. It was a clear, strong humanitarian case. And you had people like Neville Chamberlain in England who were not stepping up. They're like, yeah, sure, let's hand Hitler Czechoslovakia. So Captain America number one is a brick through the fucking window, because, you know, Lindbergh obviously didn't win. He wasn't the president in real life. But in The Plot Against America, you do see this stuff ramping up and how he was using a right-wing anti-Semitic isolationism and cloaking it in this candy-colored, we don't want to send our boys away to war. War is bad. We don't need another war. So he's trying to make it sound like he's a pacifist or that he cares about the lives of average Americans, when it's a complete lie and he just does not care about the plight of the Jewish population and the other people persecuted by the Nazis in Europe, and that he would prefer to collaborate with the Nazis, right? And then that was a time period in which you could fill Madison Square Garden with Nazi fifth columnists in the United States, right? That interventionism with a clear humanitarian case could in some places be unpopular and difficult to push for, right? My big thing there is that interventionism is bipartisan. It's not necessarily a partisan issue. It depends on where it is that they want to intervene and into what they want to intervene. Because obviously John Bolton is an interventionist, right? He was gung-ho to lead that war in Iraq. He was trying to lead us into a war with Iran when he was in the Trump administration. But he goes back to these same goofballs that were pushing Bill Clinton to the right on these issues, right? And Bill Clinton was a big interventionist president. You know, if you've seen that Ridley Scott movie, Black Hawk Down, right? And you look at Somalia, Sarajevo, all of these missions, and interventionism, military interventionism into these conflicts was an internationally popular thing. There were UN missions that were being sent to these places, right? So you see that reflected almost identically with people who would be at each other's throats now, like Chuck Dixon on the right and Greg Rucka on the left.
Right,
if you were reading them in the 90s, in the late 90s and up to 2003, and you were just looking at the kind of comics they were writing, like Birds of Prey and Checkmate and all of this, then they are not that politically different when it comes to foreign policy, because neither one of them were writing comics about gay marriage and healthcare at that time, right? That wasn't on the cultural docket. So you couldn't see the political fault lines between these guys who are now, I guess Chuck Dixon is pretty hyper-partisan. I wouldn't say that Greg Rucka is a hyper-partisan rabble-rouser, but right. The way that they get touted and invoked in the industry is that they're the North Pole and the South Pole, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas back then, on this particular set of issues, they were almost in lockstep. But Warren Ellis comes in, and he looks at this, and everybody's talking about invading, already invaded Afghanistan, gonna invade Iraq. And he does this new origin story for Iron Man that he had to have known they were going to use this for a movie. There's no way that he didn't. There had to be something in the air, something in the water, because of how Extremis was put together and how perfectly it made it into the movies. And the fact that Addy Granov was hired away immediately to work on the films as soon as that movie was, or sorry, the comic was done, basically. Mm-hmm. That they kind of had some idea that this was going to be pushed to the Hollywood wing of the company. So Ellis comes in, and the Al-Qaeda stuff is two panels. You don't even see him get kidnapped, right? Ellis is like, yeah, sure, it makes sense that Tony Stark would be in Afghanistan and that Al-Qaeda would kidnap him, but that's it. He's like, I don't give a shit about this. I'm not going to write a gung-ho Let's Invade the Middle East comic. And then he pivots to a white supremacist domestic terrorist, right? And in 2020, we're like, yeah, that's a story that makes a lot of fucking sense, right? After Charleston, yeah. After all of this, suddenly America has remembered that there's white supremacist terrorists, you know, lurking under every rock and bunker in middle America and parts of the Inland Empire in California to boot. But they never went away. And this is the whole point that Malin, this dude who gets a hold of the extremist virus or whatever it is you want to call it, he was one of the kids at Ruby Ridge. So the entire point was the continuity, that the entire culture and media did a 180 and pivoted to be like, radical Islam is the bugbear of the day, when like 30 seconds ago, it was right-wing militias. And those right-wing militias didn't say, oh, geez, well, guess we're not going to blow up the federal government now. We're just going to, you know, get Walmart greeter jobs or something. No, they continue to believe the same things they believed and get ready to do the things that they do. So that was kind of the point in Malin. His own life is the proof of the continuity of what everybody was missing, everybody was ignoring in this rush to war and this rush into Islamophobia. And that's what really makes Extremis such a unique and powerful comic for its era. And especially to look back now and see it vindicated in ways that nobody would want them to. I mean, you know, Warren Ellis wasn't like, oh man, I certainly can't wait when these kooks start showing up again.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, nobody wanted to be right about this, right? But the point was saying these guys are still here. They've been here the whole time, right?
Well, and I love that you make all these parallels as well. And they're in the text. A woman that Malin meets, she's waiting for a bus, I think. And she's like a young woman and she's being harassed by people because she fits like a quote unquote profile. And what I thought was really powerful in your essay is you take the time to really talk about like there isn't really a profile in the sense that we thought there was, and where people were like, oh, if we can just find who the shooter is, then we can do, you know, whatever it is people think they're going to do. You really point it back to like, come on, people. It's because we don't want to talk about the obvious problem, which is guns. It's like the comic has all these reflective surfaces and it's just constantly aiming back at us what is happening underlying in society, framing Tony Stark as this like deeply political, this deeply polemic character. And I think that just pays off so well in Extremis. And I think that, frankly, for me, I think it would have probably not paid off as well had I not seen it through the lenses and all the additional layers you point out. I think it's really incredible. It's like you were saying, creepily prescient for the time we are living right now comic.
Yeah. And I mean, that was actually that scene, and it's just two pages because she's a high school student on suspension for quote unquote terroristic writing because she wrote a story about her town in Texas being invaded by zombies. And like, I remember that scene when I came back to read the comic, but I didn't remember exactly what she said and what their conversation was. And it was a really just emotionally pummeling scene for me to go back through, right? Because like, I'm 35. I was in middle school when Columbine happened, right? Like, I was 13, I think, roughly at that time. And I had cousins, like I was growing up in Canada, right? But I had cousins in Denver, all we knew. My mom picks me up from school. She's upset. She's crying. I don't know what's going on. All she knows, because remember, this is like dial-up internet days. There's no Twitter. There's no social media. There's none of this stuff. All we know is there's been a school shooting in Colorado. And obviously, it's a big state, right? But you'd expect it to be somewhere urban or something. You don't know. So obviously, we get a hold of my cousins. They're in Denver. They're nowhere near Littleton, where Columbine is. But, you know, you remember that. And it's something that sticks with the same way as, you know, where were you when the towers hit? But you saw the culture change. You saw what was happening.
Right. I was going to say that I remember specifically this time period because I was in Colorado and they did Buffy. They couldn't show the season finale of Buffy for like three months because it was students that were attacking the principal. Yeah, and he turns into a giant snake. But then people were mocking that as well and saying, wow, that's too sensitive. And then there were the people who were saying, well, it was the Basketball Diaries. It was, you know, the Matrix that made people do this. And I remember we were talking about the Joker movie, and a lot of people had that really strong knee-jerk reaction that this is really going to empower the wrong kind of people. And you made a point that has always stuck with me on that, which is that they are already empowered by whatever they choose. And that, like, there's always going to be something, you know, they found the frog, you know, like they found like all of this stuff that wasn't made for them, you know, they'll always read that into it, you know? So I think that that was one of the things that you've said that I always remember, because I'm always just like, that's completely right. Like, I was not down to see the Joker movie myself, but at the same time, it made me be kind of like, this is really not the thing that people are making it out to be, I guess.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Fight Club, you know, and I don't care who.
I was just going to say Fight Club.
Yeah, and that was why I said what I said about Joker. But I kind of took Sarah Horrocks' lead on that, who is a brilliant cartoonist in her own right. You know, we remember what it was like in the Columbine era, in the immediate post 9/11 era, and when they were coming after anybody that stepped out of line in the wrong way, you know, culturally, and they would do that. But this was a thing, and there was a weird hypocrisy where people would call out Fight Club, but they wouldn't call out The Matrix. And I don't know to what extent The Matrix should have been called out, right? But, you know, what is the name of the frat boy director of Joker? What is his name? Brad Phillips? Is that it? Todd Phillips.
What is it?
Todd Phillips.
Todd Phillips, yes.
So the brutal irony of what happened is Todd Phillips comes out and he says, well, they're all coming after us and our movie. But, you know, Keanu Reeves is doing John Wick, where he's this white dude, you know, mowing people down with machine guns and all of this. I mean, obviously, no, Keanu Reeves isn't white, but it was so cowardly because really you're going to try to throw somebody else in front of the bus instead of defending your artistic decisions and kind of just the freedom of the arts in general. But then it threw me for a loop because it was just this like, wait, I've been here before, except for David Fincher isn't a fucking toddler and he never went after The Matrix. But other people were saying it and pointing out the weird doublethink on that. And in the Hellblazer issue that I talk about very ambivalently that Warren Ellis wrote and Phil Jimenez drew, and I forgot that Jimenez drew that, so that was quite the mind fuck when I was like, oh my god, that's who drew this? But they did that comic about a school shooting before Columbine, because there were other school shootings before Columbine, but it was like, you know, a couple of messed up kids in the middle of nowhere with their dad's hunting rifle, right? Stuff like that, as far as I can recall. But it's written right in the comic. And they talk about Marilyn Manson. They talk about all of the stuff that got targeted in the culture after Columbine. But Ellis turned that script in 3 months before Columbine happened.
So I noticed this parallel in the analysis around Lois Lane and also around Extremis, where the way things are just slightly twisted versus their reality counterpart or their filmic counterpart is really important. So in Extremis, it's showing Tony actually helping unload the landmines and other weaponry that makes him the arms dealer versus in the films, I don't remember what they do, but he's like they're on a humanitarian thing or like talking to the Department of Defense. I don't remember. And then in the Lois Lane case, this was incredible that you pointed this out, the way that when Lois is ejected, the rest of the press starts pushing hard on the press secretary. But that's not what happens in reality to the people who've been kicked out. Most famously, I think you were saying Jim Acosta. And it's like, that's not fun. That's no one keeps that conversation going. It ends there out of a place of fear. And those actually mean really different things for the comics and the real world counterpart. And I just thought it was they're such small moments, but they're so incredibly important for how we actually frame these wider conversations.
Yeah. Well, in Iron Man, the first movie, he's there to give a demonstration of the Jericho missile. And it, like, he is selling weapons to the army, but they're like cool cluster munitions that, like, bunker burster types, similar to the types that they did deploy in Afghanistan to try to knock out the caves that Al-Qaeda was in. So, you know, it was definitely an offensive weapon, but it was the kind that's a lot more socially acceptable than a landmine. But like the subtext of my Lois Lane piece was that, you know, when Sarah was saying, oh, you know, somebody out there saying, well, you know, Lois would be a conservative because of X, Y, and Z. And like the subtext of my piece was that the nightmare version of Lois Lane is Maureen Dowd, right? I mean, because the last line of my piece was that Lois would never let the Speaker of the House eat off of her plate. And that was a Maureen Dowd column about Nancy Pelosi taking something off of her plate when they were out for lunch. And that's kind of where it is the idea that centrism is not an ideology with its own goals and its own beliefs. It's just trying to tack towards the path of least resistance at all times. I mean, and that was kind of an issue for sure with the Lois Lane comic.
That ain't Lois.
And also that kind of, like as he said, the whole thing of this is hashtag resistance fanfic. It's not a reflection of what's going on. But it's like, you know, especially now, which was not so much an issue for extremists like a decade ago, but trying to chase the zeitgeist and get your zippy, you know, reference to what happened last week into a comic book just does not work anymore. Because like Mike Perkins, who drew the comic, like he obviously traced Sarah Huckabee Sanders in that scene in Lois Lane number one. And it's like that podium had cobwebs and spiders and, you know, other non-human creepy crawlies that aren't actually in the Trump administration hanging out on it. Like nobody was doing those press briefings anymore. You can't just keep trying to chase what the cool moment is anymore because everything happens all at once. You kind of have to, you know, to let it simmer and digest it. Or, you know, I always come back to what William Gibson says, that you have to create a world that feels perfectly antique when you roll it out. It can't be trying to catch something that happened 6 months ago.
Yes, I think that that was one of the big failings of that series. I think it's what made it work for a lot of people. I was not one of the people, I guess. And that was kind of the thing too, is that, you know, Trump's administration has constant rotating cast. So there's no way that you can make a timely observation on the cast members that surround Trump, only that they are a rotating cast, and thereby like putting somebody who is very specific in the, you know, line of sight is just kind of like, I mean, yeah, by the time that comic came out, I feel like, you know, I mean, she only had her job for a few more months or something. So, I mean, that's kind of the thing, right? I mean, he goes through people really quickly. So having an observation on that might have been really interesting, you know? But that was kind of my biggest problem, I think, with like the Lois Lane series. And it was such a bummer because everybody really liked it.
I think people so often try to use, instead of like you were suggesting, Emma, capturing the feel of these experiences and capturing the surrealness of what it is to be alive during the Trump administration, which you can capture. And you pointed out V for Vendetta really does capture the 80s in England and the sort of regressive politics that were rising again. And that ends up having such a powerful impact on the reader in that moment in time, and even today as we see this happening, you know, this cycle continuing. But when we try to do a, you know, I feel that way sometimes with Supergirl, like the TV adaptation, like I just have a hard time getting into it because I'm like, you're just trying a little bit too hard with one-to-ones here. And I think you could do a little bit more work if you weren't trying to grapple with the actual reality that we don't even understand fully yet. You know, we do, but we don't have the ramification lens of it yet. So we're playing with putty that isn't fully formed. Whereas I feel like when you're working in your own world, again, referencing back to V for Vendetta, and still pointing to the problems of the existing world the artist lives in, I think that's a very different, and to me, it always has a lot more weight when I feel like I have to draw and tease out some of those allegorical components, and it's not just delivered like, Trump doesn't like Lois Lane. It's like, okay, well, sure.
Whereas, you know, when we talk about extremists, we're talking about a series that really examined that and confronted it and came face to face with it in a way that, you know, was so impactful that I feel like they almost had to include it going forward.
Well, the one that really got me as I went through it is I finally understood the, like, the weird pseudo feud between Warren Ellis and Joe Kelly that went on for like years back and forth in comics, but I don't know if it was ever personal between them.
But they're like the weird opposite of each other.
Yeah, because of course The Authority comes out, right? And that was Warren Ellis's his own contribution to this whole contemporary interventionism, right? They're non-state actors and they're purposefully disrupting the status quo and you know, the United Nations Security Council running everything and whatnot. But, you know, he comes in with authority. They're big, they're mean, they're loud. And then Joe Kelly, and I think this is not very long after he co-wrote that issue of Wonder Woman with Phil Jimenez, when, you know, Lois is interviewing Diana and she ends up following her to the United Nations, where she gives this huge speech that it's in a brilliant, brilliant address to the United Nations that you see quoted again and again. It was one of my picks for the top 10 issues in the Shelf Dust thing I mentioned a while back. But so coming fresh off of that, Joe Kelly looks at this like, you know, the new kids on the block being the authority and this loud, ultra-violent kind of stuff. And he's like, well, fuck this. So he creates the Elite, which are just like a complete, you know, obvious parody of the authority with Manchester Black and whatnot. And Superman pretends to lobotomize him. And there's this huge, like, POV shot in What's So Funny About Truth, Justice, and the American Way, which you might also know as Superman versus the Elite, where Superman is yelling at Manchester Black, but it's like Doug Mankey's really, like, gruesome, gritty style, and Superman with, like, spit flecked and yelling, you know, how do you like it when you're deconstructed? How do you like it like this? And it's this huge blog-style rant against, like, the Warren Ellis, Mark Millar incoming era. And it's almost like Superman's yelling at the reader, like, you know, get this authority shit out of here. And then Warren Ellis fires back in Planetary. And I hadn't read the Joe Kelly comic, so I didn't understand who this Superman, Miracle Man type is that's screaming at the sort of John Constantine / Spider Jerusalem amalgam character in Planetary. But he shows up and he's yelling at this composite John Constantine about how he didn't want to know that he had been created by Nazi science and all this. And John Cassaday is aping Doug Mankey's style, like that same kind of grimy, gritty style. And then the John Constantine composite just blows him in half with a shotgun. So there's this weird back and forth that you would have had to have been paying extreme attention to between Joe Kelly and Warren Ellis that went back and forth at least twice between them in this era about the whole, what does, you know, the authority mean to the future of comic books? And like, Joe Kelly nailed it. I mean, there's a lot that you should critique about Warren Ellis's first 12 issues of The Authority, right? Like, it should be open to scrutiny. But then Mark Millar comes in, and they are the Elite. They're, like, they're rapists. They're brutal, terrible people. Not necessarily the Authority themselves, but like, the parody Avengers that Mark Millar does. And it's just this gruesome,
totally
ugly thing. And it's exactly what Joe Kelly said was going to happen.
This is when we lost Emma, unfortunately, in our call, so we don't have a proper send-off. But thank you so much for joining us, Emma. And also, if you would like to find Emma's work, you go to @EmmaHubois on Twitter, and Hubois is spelled HOUXBOIS, so Emma Hubois. And you can read Trans Mascara, and I highly recommend that you do so, at comicosity.com. We will include links to Emma's work in the show notes.
We are a podcast that is all about making comic books more accessible to LGBTQ folks and women. So if you have a question about anything related to comics, comic adaptations, pop culture in general, conventions, cosplay, you name it, that's what we're here for. You can send us your questions at bitchesoncomics@gmail.com. Unfortunately, Gmail does not like the word bitch. They're pretty judgy about it. So we can't have it spelled out. It is bitchesoncomics@gmail.com. And yeah, remember, there's no I in bitch.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Church Fire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.